Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Freedom Entrepreneur Podcast. I'm your host and business mentor, Lindsay Sutherland, and joining me today is George Rivera, who is on a fun family trip, which we'll have to tell us a little bit about that when we get going. But guys, listen, I want you to tune into today's episode because he's the founder of the Buyback Time Formula, and his website is buybacktimeformula.com, where you can learn strategically and I mean seriously about how to buy back your time. I can't wait for George to dive into his story to tell you just how valuable your time is. If you don't already know, his story will help you have a reckoning with your own. And I just want to say thank you for joining me, George.
Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to this show on whatever podcast player you prefer and follow me on Facebook and Instagram.
Thank you, Lindsay. Excited to be here.
Yeah, likewise. So please kick it off. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how did you come to see the importance of, how we can buy back our time?
Interesting. So many places to start, but I'll start way back in the beginning. So for me, this goes back to the late 80s, early 90s, like middle school, high school days for me. And in that 6 year span, I played in about 40 basketball games, and my dad only went to one of those games to watch me play. And I remember thinking, that might not that important to my dad. I just like didn't know how to compute that. And like I'd score a basket and I'd look over to the empty stands, no dad there, but my friends, my teammates would score and their dads would be cheering them on like crazy, like, oh, that's my boy. And I remember one time after one of my teammates scored and dad just loving on him, I remember looking at another dad and I was like, I wish that was my dad. And I would have crushed my dad to hear that because he was a good guy. He was just a hard worker. He was a very successful medical doctor, a great provider, gave us, nice homes and cars and trips to Europe every summer. But when I needed him the most at that time, all that didn't matter. I was like, that guy, I want him to be my dad. And so anyway, that was an interesting emotional experience at a young age. And fast forward about 20 years, which is now 10, actually 11 years ago now, it's 2015. My dad starts the year off. He's 67 years old and entering his 40th year in medical practice. And there's this phrase, God laughs at man's plans. So obviously the plans were different. And he was diagnosed with cancer early on that year. He thought he had a long run ahead of him. His parents, my grandparents, had passed away in their mid-90s, just a couple years prior, in good health, just of old age. And so he's like, all right, we're gearing up. But again, different plans for him. He was given a few months to live. He actually ended up making it to about 10 months. And a couple of weeks before he passed away, kind of like a deathbed confession or statement or something like that. I'd say more statement, but he said, don't miss Leo's games. I miss too many of yours. And Leo's my son. At the time, he was just 10 months old. And I was already blowing it, missing a lot of firsts. He was kind of an early walker, trying to talk early. I was depending on my wife to take pictures and send me videos and stuff. But when he told me that, a couple of things hit me. First, that pain I experienced as a young, teen, preteen, and then into my high school years didn't go to waste. That was kind of nice to know, some nice closure there. Didn't really ask for that. And then the other side of it was like, oh my gosh, I'm my dad all over again. Like I said, I'm missing all these important moments for my son. And but I'm doing the provider thing. I'm doing the nice homes, cars, and trips to Europe thing. And that was the first time it was like lovingly instilled in me that I couldn't keep going this way. So I'm like, all right, I'm working 16-hour days. I'll figure it out tomorrow. And then tomorrow, and then tomorrow. And then all these tomorrows turn into 3 more years. And this is 2018. And now I'm scaling a new company that I started a few years prior. That year it hit $20 million in sales. And I'm printing money. There's more money and profitable money than I could ever spend in my lifetime, or at least that's what it felt like. Unless I'm buying a helicopter every day, I should be good. Didn't buy any helicopters, but in the middle of the year, I remember, like, again, it was super profitable, but I was like hating life. And I had a, he's a dear friend now, but he was my coach and mentor at the time. And I sent him an email because he was out of town for that week. He was in Europe. He was in Rome, and I'm like, I don't want to interrupt him, but I need to send him an email because I need to vent. I need to get this off my chest, and then I'll just go back to the computer and pass out until I can't, work anymore. And I told him there's just some days that I hate this business, and I want to shut it down. I want to sell it. I want to walk away. I want to sabotage it. I'm done with it. Like, burned out. And then I was like, but call me when you're back in the States next week and we'll talk about it. And then I'm like, all right, refreshed for like another few hours. And he called me like 20 minutes later. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I didn't mean to interrupt your family time. And he's like, no, this is a distress call. This is an SOS call. We need to talk right now. And this was a 2-hour conversation. And to sum it up in a sentence or two, he says, you need to quit doing what you don't like doing and keep doing what you like doing. I'm like, okay. And I'm like 23 years in business and this finally starts to click. Whatever. I'm a late bloomer, better late than never. And then, you know, my expertise is like sales, copy, video sales, letter marketing, fun money-making side of online marketing, not admin, merchant accounts, vendor stuff, super important stuff, but it shouldn't be the same brain doing it. And that's when the whole buyback time formula began. The name didn't exist. I didn't know anything about bottlenecks and all this stuff, but that's when it started. Like, for example, I had the world's worst org chart. It was me and then 40 people underneath me. And that's what led me to working 16-hour days is because I would task down and it would boomerang back up to me because I wasn't handing over proper ownership. That's one key component that I teach now is how to handle or how to hand over proper ownership of tasks. And so it took about 2 years to really experience the full transformation of implementing this stuff because there's part of the entrepreneur identity of like, if I'm not working, I'm going backwards or I'm not providing, you know, I need to be grinding away for who knows what reason, but there's just this thing in our heads that says we need to be doing that. And then these other tasks that I had to let go, I'm like, no, I'm the only one that can do it. And so there was hesitation to fully let it go. But when I finally did, that's where my freedom began. Fast forward to, 2020, 2021, the business more than doubles to just shy of $50 million. And now I'm like living a semi-retired lifestyle. I'm not working any more than 30 hours a week. And all that time that I bought back, I poured it back into my family. I never missed any of Leo's games. You know, I honored my dad's promise. But when he said don't miss Leo's games, he also meant like don't miss out on his life. And So didn't miss his games. I taught him how to negotiate real estate at 8 years old. In fact, we're going right now to that very property he negotiated. And fast forward to current day, he has a podcast. He's going to be 11 later this month, and he's already interviewed like 20 guests, and he's got like 40 more people that want to be on his podcast. And these are friends and peers of mine. And so so that's just evidence of the impact, you know, having dad back in the picture, able to pour into my son. And so kind of coming more to current day, you know, I've had a number of friends and peers over the last couple of years tell me like, you need to teach people how you're able to do this stuff. Like, you know, you're traveling, you're still making money, and you know, you still have a business, but you're pouring into your family. Like, how do you do this? And I'm like, okay, how do I teach this? Do I teach people how to travel, how to buy real estate, how to start a business? And I'm like, I don't think those are the things. And then it hit me like in the middle of last year, 2025, buy back time. Like if you can get yourself out from being the bottleneck in your business, you can use that time for whatever you want in your life. For me, I'm family first, father first kind of guy. Like pour it back into your family, not into your business. So, you know, to speak marketing speak, my avatar, my ideal client is someone who's cash rich, time poor, the me of 10 years ago. And so I'm like, okay, I got to get this message out there because I know there's other dads like me that are like, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do. I built myself what I call the founder prison. I'm stuck in this prison and there's no way out. My family's planning a life without me. You know, the average woman thinks for 2 years before leaving their husband. So there could be some time to save the family. Kids are being raised by iPads and iPhones instead of dad present in the house. And so I'm like, I'm doing it for the kids. I'm doing it for the dads. Like let's get these families back together and succeeding, not just their family, but for generations. And I feel like I went off a little bit on track. You asked me about how the buyback time formula started. Hopefully that gave you a nice picture and we can dig in wherever you like from there.
I was muted because there was a big truck going by. Interesting while you were talking. It dawned on me something that hadn't occurred to me before. It occurred to me from a female perspective, but not a male perspective. And that's, you know, when I was working in the car business, I was in the same boat, you know, George. My dad was a flooring contractor. My mom died when I was 12. And, you know, when you lose a parent young, you recognize the importance of making memories and family, right? And I can remember my dad provided a good life for us, but then it was the same thing. Like he wasn't there in certain ways that I wanted him to be there. And I remember thinking, like, just like you were like, I wish my dad was here. I wish that of my dad and my mom. My dad physically was on earth, but, you know, he wasn't always present because he was so busy. God bless him. He was providing for a family, you know, without my mom in the picture. So I totally give him grace. But I think our generation has a really interesting, like yours and my generation, and it is like this 10, 20-year span where we kind of grew up in this belief system of you must work hard to make money. Your worth comes from your work, right? That's why I hustled so hard in the car business. For what, I don't know. Like, where was it? It hit me one day, actually. One of my service managers and the GM, they used to have a place up here in Eureka, Montana, which is just like 30 minutes from my house. And they would come up here and spend like 2 weeks a year. And this was what they lived for, this 2 weeks. And I thought, that's pathetic. Like, I want to live there all the time, not just 2 weeks, right? And so I'm like, how am I going to make that happen? And then so I went about it in that capacity, but I still find that there's, and I always thought it was like a female thing. Like I felt this intense pressure to be, I'm the primary breadwinner. I've got to make the money. I was used to making a lot of money. So that was my intentional focus. Yet meanwhile, I felt that same pain that you're feeling that your wife was doing, but I had a nanny. You know, she's sending me pictures of my kids' first words and the arts and crafts they're making. And I mean, it stung deeply, like, oh, I'm not there. I should be there. I'm their mother. And so feeling that dual, it was almost like dual roles, like this dichotomy, you know, like I'm got this masculine energy at the workplace, and then I'm like missing out on this feminine thing, and I'm just out of balance, right? And I think it's so cool now how this conversation isn't just for females. It's not just for working moms. It's about dads too. And this call to be present in the home is so needed. It's like it just you just brought that to my attention. Like what a shift we're in right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you're so right on maybe it's the cultural thing. I'm a Gen Xer. I don't know where I fall on the whole Gen X thing. Probably more on the younger side of them if I'm doing my numbers correctly. But I think it's the generation that because like I'm guessing Gen Xers come from baby boomers or maybe somewhere in that range. But anyway, that was the generation that really like worked really really hard, like trading time for dollars, that kind of work. And and I just remember my dad telling me, because like I said, he provided us a really good lifestyle, like materially. He wasn't there much, so it came at an expense. But he would say, hey, if you want to maintain this kind of stuff, you're gonna have to work very hard. And so I just remember thinking, like, okay, I don't want to go backwards. So yes, I'm gonna have to work very hard. And so a couple of years before my dad passed away, had you seen me hanging out with my dad, I would have been high-fiving him, saying, Dad, you showed me what it is to be a real man. I'm doing the nice cars and homes and trips to Europe thing just like you did. And I could see when I would do that, he'd kind of have this look, and he didn't have to say anything, kind of like, son, it's not all that it's cracked up to be, but I maybe he didn't want to deflate my balloon, but then he finally told me towards the end of his life like how he really felt. But I think that's just something in that generation that that they passed down to us, and it's up to us to sort of clarify that for the next one, that doesn't have to be all that.
Well, and what's also funny is I look at my kids. I don't know how old your kids are, but my oldest is 17 and my youngest is 10. And I watch them how they think so differently. And like my oldest, I always, it's gonna sound mean, but it's not mean. It's like in some ways we look at him and think, oh, he's so lazy, right? And it dawned on me, I'm like, he's not lazy, he's efficient. He's very efficient, almost to the point where it's like, if it just doesn't make sense, he won't do it. And I'm like, man, I wish I could be more like that. Like he taught me what it means to be efficient with my time. Because he even said to me one day, he said, Mom, I wish I could be more like you. You have such a gift of being able to like do something that's hard even when you don't want to. Meanwhile, I was like, I wish I could do less of that because it's just to your point when you were sitting there at your workplace doing wearing all the hats, managing this team of 40 people, doing these things that you just hated to do. That's literally what our parents taught us is that grit and that ability to, you know, fortify ourselves and stick to something even though it's hard because that's where worth and value came from. And essentially flipping the script and saying, no, worth and value comes from being able to being a good manager, managing your time, being able to build, but not being the guy and gal that does everything. So I don't know, it's just such a different way of thinking.
Yeah, that's true. And yeah, it takes a lot of yeah, maybe it's repetition or just changing habits to sort of get there, because yeah, it's just ingrained in us, and if we're not told or shown any other way, we just kind of go on autopilot, like this is it. And then at least in my case, I end up in the founder prison, and I'm like, oh my gosh, like I built myself a cell. How do I get out of this thing? And then I end up hating my business, and it's printing money. Like I'm on top of the world entrepreneurially, materially, financially, but at what cost? Cost of my sanity, cost of spending time with my family. And yeah, so anyway, that's something, yeah, that I learned about myself, is that I like to like scale and scale hard, and but now we got to be efficient with how we do that, and realize, hey, your family's not asking you to work this hard for this many things. I mean, sure, it's tough to rewind or unwind a lifestyle once they get used to it. That's not fun or anything, but yeah, I think, our presence as parents for our children mean a lot more than whatever it is we're hustling hard for.
So true. If you could go back and do it over again, how would you do it differently?
Yeah, I mean, I would have implemented or adopted the concept of outsourcing things much sooner in my life. And like rewind, say 10, 11 years, and you tell me, hey, you should have delegated that, I'd say, I am delegating and I'm still doing it. Well, there's a proper way to delegate, like I said, which is transferring ownership, teaching your people or showing your people that you're delegating to what the outcome looks like, so that there's a path there, and also give them decision rights to improve upon that process as well. Assuming you hire them right, that's another process that I talk about too, but assuming you hire them right, and they have the intelligence to do the task properly, give them the liberty to be more efficient with it, and give them decision rights. Like for example, I used to get bugged by several people on my team all the time about buying this and that, and I'm like, if it's under $1,000, don't bother me, just get it, and if it's over, then we'll talk about it. And then that eliminates like 90% of the can we buy this questions. However, you don't just want to say that and then ignore it, because then you got a bunch of $500 things on recurring, and that's like 6 grand a year. So you don't want to do that either. So with the people that you delegate to, you want to have a weekly cadence. It could be, or it could be weekly, it could be quarterly, but determine the cadence so that you can review things, their decisions that they made, so that you can, make corrections or adjustments, including financial. Did we need this? What's the outcome? Can we cancel it? Or, is it essential that we have it? Like, have those conversations, but give them some decision rights, and that's how you start buying back time, is by letting them make decisions on their own, assuming they're qualified. And again, that's a process that I go into as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. One time when I was working in the car business, there was this guy. He was a GM at a store in New Mexico. And he had kind of branded himself as the yes man. You know how car guys are really good at like making their GM like a superstar of
Yes.
the town. It was this guy. He was a part of the Larry Miller organization, which is what I was a part of. Anyway, they sent me out to the store. And what the whole concept was is exactly what you're saying. He gave everybody a dollar amount to the goal. The ultimate goal was customer service. If they had to say yes to a customer to get them to be happy, they could spend up to da da da, right? If they dinged a car in the car wash, let's not debate about was the ding there when you got here. Let me get you some touch-up paint, right? Simple stuff like that. And a lot of dealerships were like totally against this. This was not normal. Most dealerships are greedy, you know,
Yeah.
like lack of a better word. And so they're going to nitpick over the ding. But when he made that plan, and his customer relations director was in charge of managing all of that, now at a certain point, if it escalated, she got involved and so on. I got to see their whole operation, and that. What you're just talking about right there is that pivotal thing that made them the number one dealership in Albuquerque.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's awesome. So yeah, sometimes it's those little things, and it's yeah, that gets you all the freedom, or yeah, treating customers properly, all that stuff counts big
It's
time.
so important. But like you said, they have to know what the outcome is, right? Like we can spend this much money, but for what purpose? And so I
Yeah.
think that's what he did a good job of, was just establishing that purpose. And I wanted to share that for the listening audience so they could see clearly how that kind of pan out. So other than like delegating it with a specific strategy, was there other, what other parts of your system did you implement or would you implement?
Yeah, so even before the delegation part, you have to do what's called, well, I call it a freedom audit, but it's just an audit of your time. And I know when people hear that, because I was the same way, I'm like, well, I put stuff on my calendar, but it's not like I put, oh, 20 minutes I was doing this or that specifically. So don't worry about the past if you don't keep great detailed records, but start now, you know, for 2 weeks, and you'll start identifying things in 2 or 3 days. But go for 2 weeks, because that's long enough to really identify some patterns. And it's like, what do you write down? I put down everything, and I suggest people do too, like brushing your teeth, going to the bathroom, cooking, and then your tasks. Act as if there's a camera on you 24/7, you know, time when you go to bed, when you wake up. Because if you start to scrutinize, oh, should I do this, should I do that, then you're not going to get an accurate picture of the things that you're doing. And you're going to identify, oh my gosh, I'm killing so much time doing this, and or I could totally have somebody else, you know, be doing that. Like, for example, in my case, some weeks I'm working 60 to 80 hour weeks back in the day before implementing this. But let's just go with 60 hours. When I did my own freedom audit, I identified that 40 hours per week I was doing tasks that could have been handled for $50 or less. Remember, this is back in the old money printing days. And I'm like, wow, so I'm not really good at math, but, you know, 40 hours times $50 an hour is $2,000 a week. So for $2,000 a week, I could buy back more than half of my freedom. I'm like, oh my gosh, like that, I like that math. That's kind of a no-brainer. And now the 20 hours that I'm working in what I call the zone of genius, which is revenue generating activities. For me, it's networking, it's finding strategic partners to grow my business with, it's coming up with new offers and, you know, new angles, new places to buy media, new ways to like optimize the business. Like, that's my zone of genius. So instead of the old way, you know, 60 hours a week and then maybe 20 hours in my zone of genius, but I'm frustrated, burned out, like not enjoying life. So that's like those hours are essentially like working on fumes. And now removing those 40 hours, now those 20 hours, you might as well like multiply them times 10 in terms of effectiveness and efficiency and enjoying life again. Like that's how anyone can like double their business by working less. And it's kind of counterintuitive. It's not like, hey, I'm going to work less, so the business is going to collapse. It's not magically supported either. It's done by frameworks and systems that I talk about in the buyback time movement, I should say. There's also a book by the same name, but yeah.
I didn't even know that. That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, I think it's so valuable. And with the amount of resources that there are available today between virtual assistants, technology, I mean, AI agents can also handle quite a bit. I mean, there's really no reason why we can't be more strategic with that. I think sometimes we're doing something for the sake of doing it, or because we just think it's faster if I just do it myself. I'm guilty of that. That's probably my biggest, I guess, excuse for just doing stuff. I was, in fact, listening to you, I thought, I wonder how many other people might have that same objection to you. Like when you're coaching them, do you get that objection where people are like, yeah, but George, I feel like it takes this guy like 3 hours. It takes me 15, 20 minutes. And it just frustrates me to pay them for their time when I know it could be done faster.
Yeah, that was me. I was the poster boy for that. You know, when I would task down to my team of 40, it'd boomerang back up to me. And then I would rob from the future by just telling them, hey, let me just knock it out right now. You know, yeah, 15 minutes instead of 3 hours. You know, I kind of have this new definition of insanity, which is, of course, the old one's doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. For me, the new one, in addition to that one, is like when you pay somebody to do something and then you end up doing it anyway, that's kind of insane. And I was insane for years by that definition. I'm no longer insane, but it's kind of crazy when you think about it. Like, I'm paying you to do this, but now it's coming back up to me. I'm just going to do it real quick. And I'm like, why are you on payroll? And I had so many people like that. And I'm like trying to figure stuff out for them to do, because I'm thinking I'm being a good manager, but in reality, just completely wasteful, irresponsible, and all that. But now I know better. So that doesn't happen.
Well, and
anymore.
It makes you feel bitter too, because you're like, you're trying to provide them a good lifestyle, but you're feeling like they're not reciprocating.
Yeah.
Word.
Yeah.
You know, and so then you start to feel that like bitterness, and it just goes around and around. And oh my gosh, I completely understand what you're saying. Yeah,
absolutely. So yeah, I quit doing all that, but I know exactly what that is. I'll just do it myself. I hear it all the time. And I love hearing that, because that's like the easiest thing to solve for.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, even still, if it costs you like, let's say $25 an hour, which is, I think, a pretty decent wage for an average worker. And if it does take them 3 hours, but you're still charging $100 to $200 an hour, you're still doing better to outsource it, even if it takes them longer, and they'll get more efficient over time. I don't know. I don't know. I want to go into a deep dive here for a second because I'm just curious. Like, do you ever suggest, or is this in your book, or maybe you just coach on it, or maybe it's not even in your space at all? But do you ever teach on how to basically, I reward people based on performance. And so, say I have a virtual assistant that I want to teach to do my podcast editing. I might say, yes, I'm only going to pay you this dollar amount, which might be small, but it'll increase the more efficient you get, right? Or something like that. Have you ever tried something like that?
I not that specifically. I do give bonuses for good performance. Kind of just usually it's around Christmas, just appreciation. And if I don't feel like they deserve it, I might hold back on it or it might be less. But yeah, no, I love that idea of like, yeah, kind of a motivation, something to motivate them for being more efficient. And it sort of gives them a little bit of liberty to like find new pathways to get it done quicker and cheaper and more beneficial. Actually, I love that idea.
Yeah, I found it was really effective, especially because I would find people, and I'm just kind of speaking to the listening audience too. I would find people who were capable, but maybe hadn't done it yet. So part of the reason I was paying less is because I was teaching them, which was beneficial to me because it was going to get done the way I wanted it. But then I'm like, look, you're going to have a skill. You'll be able to market yourself and do this for other people, right? And so part of that exchange, it's kind of like to me, it's like with real estate. If you're a real estate investor and you're teaching other people, you're getting a part of their deal. It's kind of the same essentially. And then the more efficient they get, the better they get, then you start to pay them the wage that that position pays, but they're also trained.
No, I love it. Yeah, anything that'll get the best out of your people, I'm all about that. Yeah, keeping them motivated.
So what other, give us another good nugget that's in your book that we might want to go check it out for. Like what would be the biggest benefit?
I mean, one thing too, like with any task, once you do your audit, there's three things you could do with any task. Obviously, one of them is keep doing it because that's in your zone of genius, but there's three things to get it off your plate, which is automate. Actually, I'd say eliminate. Start with eliminate, automate, and delegate. Doesn't have to be in any particular order, but eliminate, things that don't need to exist. It could be like recurring meetings, things that could be handled with a simple email. Sometimes we just have meetings, and I'm guilty of this, where it's like, all right, we're just going to touch base, and really like nothing gets accomplished, or this could have totally been done in like a 2-minute loom or something. Yeah, getting rid of meetings for the sake of just touching base. Like if it's like a quick 15-minute thing, like here's what's worked, here's what's not working, here's what I need help with kind of thing. Like that's kind of different, but just meetings for the sake of meeting, I think is a potentially a big waste of time. So I wouldn't go off and like cancel your meetings. Just make sure that are you really getting the most out of it, and then make a decision from there. And then automate things that repeat. With AI, obviously that simplifies a lot of that process. So many things can be automated. Even like you can kind of blend, the eliminating and automation together by like having your AI note taker join meetings, and maybe you're like number two or something, attending, and then sort of like then you review the notes and see if there's action for you there. That's just a simple example, but there's so many others. And then the last one, like I said, delegating, but delegating with ownership and decision rights. And yeah, those are the only three things you could do with any task. And that's kind of where it all starts. And then there's like kind of just going deeper into delegation with ownership. One of the favorite things that I like to do is I'll like do a Loom or screen share recording. Loom's the popular one, and kind of go over the whole task. And then I'll take the transcript and I'll put it in ChatGPT, and I'll have ChatGPT make this amazing, SOP, standard operating procedure. Then I review it because, it's not perfect, but it'll get it like 95% there. You tweak it, and then I'll put it on a Google Doc and I'll paste that SOP there along with the Loom video. Then the person that I'm tasking it to, I'll say, please watch this. I got 15 minutes right now. Just watch it. I'm here. Let me know if something's not clear. And then watch it. Oh, answer this or that. Maybe I got to tweak something. Tweak. All right. How are you now? Okay, good, good. I should never, ever see that again, ever. As long as they're on my team, like that is theirs to own, theirs to improve. If you have a question, we can schedule a time. But like, yeah, don't be pinging me about this. This is your task. You own it. And you're showing them what the outcome looks like. You're giving them the liberty to even improve upon it. Hey, you want to talk about ideas? We can do that too. So that should never come back to me unless, like, you know, there's a vendor change or technology change, then we need to tweak it or whatever. That's just one example of how to get it off your plate to where it should never, never come back into your orbit. And yeah, there's other things too, but yeah, I
That's
could
a
go.
no, that's a good one because it's pretty clear. I was very clear and concise, and I think can work for entrepreneurs at any level, you know. Even if they're just getting started and they've got their first virtual assistant, I find that virtual assistants can be some of the hardest people to deal with. It's like one thing when you're hiring with a W-2 employee because I don't know, there's a different mindset between them and a virtual assistant. In some cases, I know some virtual assistants that are amazing, but you had to interview lots to find them, right? Most virtual assistants are taskmasters and doesn't mean they really are about quality, they're about quantity because they're selling their time. And so those are the ones that I struggled with a lot in the beginning. It was like I would give them a task, it would come back to me, I would end up fixing it, and then I would be annoyed that I paid them. And then they want me to pay them again for them to fix it. That was like another annoying thing. But when you have somebody who's on your team and they work for you, you're hiring because they have that skill. They want to do good for you. Like they want to keep you happy so they don't lose their job. Like it's a whole different mindset. It's definitely better, I think, if you can go the W-2 route.
No, absolutely. Yeah, and just making sure you got the right people for the right role and hiring right from the beginning. You know, like you know, Upwork's is one of the best places to hire people for online tasks, and you know, put in little things in there to make sure that they read the whole you know, the whole job description. You know, because now you've got people just kind of replying to everything, and then it's like, oh, how do I pick from all these people? Well, you got to have the cream rise to the top by, you know, putting little nuggets in there that'll tell you if they read the job description. Like, for example, I was posting an ad for my real estate business. I'm looking for a closer, and like when you reply, your first line needs to say, "I am your closer," and then get into like why you think you are. And of course, with AI, you know, they could paste it, and AI is gonna be like, "Hey, there's a little thing in here," you know, but. You also like ask them to do a Loom video and ask them four or five questions that reveals a little bit about their personality. Maybe they're not specific to their job. A couple should be, so you get deeper on that, but then a couple more about their personality. You know, if they were a superhero or if they could be a superhero, what would their superpower be or something like that, just to see, you know, if they can get out of that, you know, robotic, you know, work mode, see if they've got personality. And that
Because if
tells you
they
a
don't
lot
pay
too.
attention to detail, then they're not the right fit.
Yeah, exactly. And that makes it so much easier. You'll eliminate all these like hundreds of people saying, "Oh, I'll, you know, check me out." You're like, "No, you didn't follow instructions."
That's awesome.
I literally don't like, and you'll still get those people that they don't even read it. They're just like, "I want to apply for this job. I don't even read after the I part." Like, you didn't put the "I'm your closer," you know? So like, you didn't do it. So I'm not even wasting my time. So that's how you'll get a handful of really qualified people, and then at least you have a nice place to start.
That's a good point. We had success. My friend, she was helping me at the time, was a part of a Facebook group which was full of virtual assistants. It was like a Facebook group where virtual assistants helped support each other type of a thing. And she was in on this group. She was freelancing herself. And I put an ad in there that I was hiring for something specific. And then she interviewed these people. And I want to tell you, we probably interviewed, I want to say 50 or 70 people. I mean, it was a lot of people. And out of that, we ended up with, I want to say, three really solid people that I still use to this day. And that's been like 3 years later. So that's another way, too, is to just really interview the snot out of people and like have a huge list of people to start with. And then you just kind of pare it down.
Yeah, exactly. I'm kind of go through little phases. I even give them a little sample task to do. You know, something related to the job and see how they do it. But yeah, one of the tasks I did was, or have going right now is for a research project. And, you know, I need to research 100 different people. And I'm like, "Here, just give me one person, do the research, and we'll see if you understand the task." And so, yeah.
I love it. That's smart. Well, where can people go to get your book and to learn more about you?
Yeah. I'd say buybacktimeformula.com is the best place. There you'll find a link to my book. It's free, just pay shipping. It's a heavy book. I mean, it's 128 pages. Little to no fluff. I say the only fluff that's in there is supporting the techniques and strategies. So there's a little story as to why they're required, but I don't know. I wouldn't call that fluff, but yeah, basically setting up the frameworks and all that, horror stories and successes and everything in between, as far as getting that implemented. And I pour everything I know about buying back time in that book. So there's no, like, you want the big secret, go here and pay me $5,000 for it. Like, it's all in the book. There is the opportunity to get more help because I know my people, my avatar of cash rich time poor. Again, going to me of 10 years ago, I would have paid a mini fortune to collapse the time it took from me being prisoner to freedom, to the semi-retired lifestyle. Not saying you'll be semi-retired, but, to buying back time essentially. So I'm available to help if that's the case for any, you know, any listener, but yeah, I'd start with a book, buybacktimeformula.com, and all my socials are on there. I post daily on Facebook and some of the other socials. I syndicate the same, similar content, but yeah, Facebook, LinkedIn, it's all, you can find me from that page, buybacktimeformula.com.
I love it. And we'll link that in the show notes, friends. So go check it out.
Awesome.